Blog Talk Radio.
Pacho Benson, it always makes me want to, join a commune and become a hippie or something. This is Andre Traversa. You're listening to The Cosmic Citizen. With me is my gracious, lovely co-host, Crystalline Beek. How are you this morning, Crystalline?
I'm doing very well. Andre, how are you?
I'm doing very well myself. And I want to just let everybody know that Crystalline has been so good to me these last few weeks because I've been so swamped with all kinds of things. I've not been as good at updating people about the show and getting. She's been great. She's been getting guests. She's been doing a lot of the things that I normally do for the show, and I just want everybody to know that she's been doing a fantastic job. So,
well, thank you,
Crystalline. You just are. You rock. What can I say? Okay. And so, Crystalline, because you've been so good and gracious, I'd like to ask you again to introduce our guest and kind of introduce the show for us today and kind of give us an idea of what we're going to be talking about.
Well, today we're fortunate to have two of the co-founders of the Inner Life International's organization, Thomas Orgila and Meredith Tenney. They're this week's guest speakers, and I'm going to let them tell you a little bit more about Inner Life International, but I'm going to tell you a little bit about them. Meredith is a visionary program director and interfaith minister. She has degrees in law, public health, and nurse midwifery. She co-founded the East Coast Women's Corps and was the creator and director of Adolescent Preventive Services, an innovative program for at-risk youth. Meredith has been a contributing author to the book Spiritual Awakening and a guest panelist at the World Brotherhood Union Symposium in Istanbul. Thomas Orgila began reading the book in the late 60s and has since had a passion for introducing the book to new readers. He's been a member of the General Council for the Urantia Book Fellowship since 2003. He was a volunteer with the Family of God Foundation, so he had sort of that background as well. And he's the chair of the Outreach Committee. He's also one of the co-founders of Inner Life International, and he's helped design some new programs like the Cosmic Cafe, which he holds in his home, I think, every week. Anyway, Meredith and Tom, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good to be here. This is a great show, and I'm so glad you guys are doing it. It's really fun to listen to different programs, and it really kind of has a it gives me a sense of what's going on in our movement because there's so many wonderful things happening, and I just love hearing you guys interview people, and so we know what we're doing, and so we're all kind of encouraged by each other's actions.
Thanks. Yeah, it has been a wonderful way to get information about new projects that are going on out there and to help us keep in touch with each other.
Mm-hmm.
Would one of you, I guess Thomas, would you like to talk about Inner Life International? And both you and Meredith can tell us how the organization was started.
Yes. You know, the whole thing kind of got started when Les Jameson and I were talking one day on the phone. We'd call each other back and forth, and we were just saying, you know, it'd be nice to do something that would just be kind of visionary and kind of look at what's possible for the Urantia movement. And that led to us co-leading a workshop in East Stroudsburg at one of the summer study sessions. And
Thomas, we're having a little bit of a problem hearing you. Can you speak up a bit?
All right. Let me not use my headset and see if that helps.
That's much better.
Okay, good. Yeah, sometimes the headsets don't work too good. Well, what happened is we did a workshop in East Stroudsburg, and in that room was some really interesting people, and these ideas just started popping and popping, and pretty soon we'd formed a little group, which we called SOAP, which is Service Outreach Action Project, and that led to a meeting in Coeur d'Alene, in which we spent a weekend just kind of hammering out what this organization could look like. And we created what we call the Transformation Declaration, which was us declaring that we would be about this work until it was done. We were going to cause transformation and put in place programs and new ideas that would bring about the changes that the planet needs. And that led to two meetings at Silver Springs in Canada at the Tenet's place, where we hammered out farther who we were and what we were going to be about. And that led to Fred Harris setting us up as a 501c3, and anyway, maybe American fell in some of the rest of it.
Wow. So what do you got? Okay, I don't mean to be flippant about this, but what do you guys do?
What do we do?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the goal of the organization has always been to create new projects and paradigms that would cause ourselves to become trained. As we take on projects, it trains us how to do projects better. You know, we look at something that's needed. We say, okay, let's create a program to bring that into existence, and let's bring people into the organization and into these projects and train them on how to do it. And as we get good at it, we do get a project completed. We do have something happening. Plus, it's just like working with the family of God. All the people that went through the family of God, I noticed, are our leaders in our movement now. They're all dynamic people making a huge difference. And I could really see how working with organizations and programs is a great training ground to create future leaders.
Okay, but give me some specifics of projects that you guys have worked on.
Well, like the Cosmic Cafe, which Crystal mentioned, is one. You know, I was
what is that? So the listeners, know what it is.
The Cosmic Cafe came about is, like a lot of people, I've been in a study group for a lot of years, but I reached a point where I thought, well, you know, I study, and it doesn't make any difference in the world. Like, why would I just keep studying this book when the book talks about service? And so I said, I'm just going to take a break from studying, and I'm going to go out there and figure out how to be of service. And one thing I noticed is that, I was at a group one time. There was a whole bunch of us Urantians sitting there meditating, and after the meditation, we kind of around and said what it meant to us, and people say, oh, I saw spirits and I saw filthy angels. And when it came to me, I said, well, what I see is a whole bunch of really wise people sitting around a room that have tons of wisdom but have no outlet for it. And I said, it's really frustrating to me that we kind of absorb this great revelation, but we don't create ways to go share it in the public. And so the Cosmic Cafe was an answer to taking study groups to another level, which now we meet in a public setting. We don't actually meet in my home. We find a public setting where we can invite the public. We put some flyers around town, and we have some interesting topics, and people come because they want to hear about whatever the topic is. And it's an open discussion. Anybody can share anything they want, but in the course of that conversation, I, of course, get to interject my viewpoints, which happen to be from the Urantia book largely, and people have always been really responsive and very receptive to these ideas that I share. So it's a way to actually seed the revelation out into humanity.
So is it, correct me if I'm wrong, I thought the Cosmic Cafe, because I know some other people have started it, isn't it, have also done it in other cities, do you often meet like at coffee shops? Is it kind of like there's a I'm trying to think of a word for the. I mean, is that kind of what you do? Like
a public,
is it kind of like the kind of the kind of a Starbucks study group?
well, we try to find a quiet place. Like usually a coffee shop will have a back room, like a little meeting room, and that way it's nice and quiet. You're not being disturbed by other conversations. And if it's in a public setting, people don't feel intimidated. We did meet at a Unity Church for probably 6 months, and it was kind of like the church felt like we were competing with them or something. And it might have been this particular church, but so we kind of went back to just meeting in a public space that was neutral. You know.
Okay. And how do you alert the public that you have this thing going on?
Well, we do emails with. If people come to the meeting, we'll grab their email and put them on our list. And so if we change locations or change our topics or something or have a new
And you just have to email people that you know, or how do you – do people just email their people
well,
they know
yeah.
and invite
you know,
them?
I've got people I think might be interested, so I'll send them a copy of our flyer through email. And then we'll put flyers around town, just tack them up on, you know, wherever there's a bulletin board.
I'm going to interrupt. I'm going to interrupt you guys again and just say to please speak as loud as you can. On the chat room, we're hearing from everyone that they're having difficulty hearing both Andre and Thomas. So just
do
your best to speak louder and maybe a little slower.
Yeah, I need to put my mouth closer to the phone too. I'm sorry, Crystal, go ahead.
I would also like to ask Meredith for a little bit of her background on Inner Life International and how she got involved.
Well, I just happened to be lucky enough to be sitting in the room in East Stroudsburg that day when Thomas launched his workshop. And I was inspired by his thoughts and ideas then, as I am again today, Thomas. Oh, well said, brother. It is time for all of us to get up out of our seats and be of service, to take the wisdom that we have garnered from the fifth epical revelation and put it to work in the world. So I certainly do see that as the mission of Inner Life, and it's been a wonderful organization to be a part of.
So true. Well, I think all of the organizations that are out there are doing good work. What I felt like is there wasn't a lot going on that really looked to the future. Like a lot of what we were doing, maybe it's been guided by past leaders who said, well, maybe we should kind of go slow and just kind of chug along at a certain pace. And I think there's a kind of a group of us that felt like, you know, maybe. Slow growth isn't all that hard to achieve, but a more steady growth would be take some real effort, and I think that's where we're coming from, is now is the time to step out and to introduce more people to the book, to put up some activities that prepare us for the future.
In your overview of Inner Life that you sent to us, you said that it was formed to act as a catalyst in forming new programs and paradigms that would train and develop leaders while accomplishing specific service goals. And I was hoping you would talk about some of the new programs that you guys have been involved with.
Well, I think the Garden Project is a great example of Inner Life International stimulating a new project into existence, and I'd like to hear Mayor explain that.
Well, Thomas, I'd love to explore a little more the other activities of Inner Life, too, but before we get into that.
I think that's a good idea, because the Garden Project is sort of such a large and exciting and dynamic program. I'd like to give a good half hour of the show to Meredith's description of that. So why don't we start with some of the other
programs? All right. Let's do an overview then. You know, one project we're doing now is we've started something called the Ambassador Program of Urantia. And the goal of that is to provide people that have a good idea, let's say. And I hear good ideas all the time, or people say, well, we ought to have this in the world, but they don't know how to go about it. And there's people that have been in businesses or been in organizations that really understand how to take an idea and take it through to completion, how to make it happen in the world. And so the Ambassador Program is a way to train people by having them mentored or coached with somebody who understands how to get their project accomplished. And it's a model that works like in Europe. When you want to learn how to be a mechanic, you're put in a mentorship program and you come out as a great mechanic. And I think we need to do the same thing with the Revelation. It's kind of like learning to replace yourself. Like if we're knowledgeable in how to do certain things, why don't we make sure there's 10 people that we leave trained on the planet before we go? And right now we have, I believe, 6 mentors, 6 ambassadors that we're working with that have various programs, and there's more that are talking about sending in their application. It's a very easy process where you basically fill out an application, say this is what I'd like to do, and then you're assigned a coach, and your coach will work with you to kind of fine-tune exactly what you want to do. And then we set up calls and emails where each step is laid out. So, okay, here's the next thing you do, here's the next thing you do. And it's really a thrill to watch programs that were just an idea at one time actually start to come into existence. So,
Let me ask you, so you have 6 mentors and 6 ambassadors. Does someone have to be, okay, I'm assuming, correct me if I'm wrong, maybe I'm wrong, I'm assuming someone has to be an ambassador before they become a mentor. What if somebody really feels that they can mentor someone right away?
Well, that's perfectly fine. We're not.
Wow. Okay.
We don't have a rigid structure how it works. What InterLife wants to do is set up the model, and we don't want to make it a rigid. Oh, you just have to do it a certain way. Like cosmic cafes show up in all shapes and sizes and forms. I'm amazed when I hear of certain people doing what they call a cosmic cafe, and I say, well, that's not the way we do it, but hey, it's working. That's good. And I think with the Ambassador Program, we're basically saying, here's a model that works. Please use it however it works for you. And if you see somebody that you think you can coach and mentor and give a little training to, you know, go for it. You don't even have to fill out an application, just do it. But what we find is that formalizing it with an application and making it a little more formal, people actually do their project. They've signed the document. They say, yes, this is what I'm going to do. We're really clear about what we're going to do. We've set some timelines, some you know, parameters, and now we're going to go do it. And it gives it more life.
Can I speak to that for just a minute? As
sure.
As someone who has participated in the Ambassador Program, as the mentee, not the mentor, I just like to say that I found the process marvelously helpful. You know, here I was carrying around this dream of something I would like to do, but it was the structure that the Ambassador Program provided and the consistent support from my coach, who was Aurora, that really got the project off the ground. Couldn't have done it without her. Found the whole, it's a great idea, and it really works, Thomas.
It does work good, and we should say that Aurora Hill is the director of that program, and she's a very well-trained coach, mentor person who just has got a real knack for helping people get to wherever they want to get to, so. It's a resource that needs to be used. So, I'm really hoping that people out there listening, you know, who have a burning idea, actually contact us and say, you know, I've had this idea for a while, and I'm just kind of stopped. I don't know how to get it done. You know, what can I do? Because we're more than happy to make sure that thing comes, you know, is a reality in not too many years. So use us.
How would someone go about contacting you, Thomas, if they were interested in getting involved with the Ambassador Program?
I think the best thing is just to send an email, and somewhere in this program will, I assume, give some contact information out.
Well, let's go ahead and give it out now. We can probably repeat it again later.
All right. Well, my email is T-O-M-O, like Tom O, at imaxmail.net, imaxmail.net.
Thanks.
You bet.
Thank you for that.
So another project.
Well,
I
wanted to just mention that I also have taken advantage of your coaching and mentoring, and I'm doing some work with outreach to young readers, and as a result of your coaching, I contacted the two leaders of the Truth Seekers program and asked if I could help expand their reach, and they were just thrilled to find out that there was someone out there who wanted to help expand that program, and we've just been working together for less than a month, and we already have a new Truth Seeker program happening the same week as the summer session in Chicago. There's going to be a Truth Seeker event happening in Eugene, Oregon. So it does seem like getting involved with the Ambassador Program does really help you get your stuff off the ground.
It does. Yeah, it's kind of hard to explain to people maybe the difference it makes, but I think we've all had the experience of having a great teacher or an uncle or somebody who just kind of watched our back for us and kind of gave us those little pointers. We didn't even know they were pointers sometimes. They just would say something in a conversation. All of a sudden, we were smarter and could get more done in life. So, and that's what a coach and a mentor does for a person, is just shows them the next step. So it's a great program. And I also want to mention, like, campus outreach is something. You know, working with the fellowship, we were really getting a burning desire to get onto campuses. We've talked about it for a couple of years, and now I think the time has come. And Inner Life is working with that as well to create product, I call it, something that we can actually give to the youth when we're on the campuses. And we've created some really beautiful flyers to hand out, some cards that are double colored on both sides and very attractive, and we're making some posters, and we've got some banners in the works. So when we show up in the campuses, we're going to really have some nice stuff to present to them. We're not going to feel like we're just out there with our hat on. We're actually going to be able to present great things that they can take home. We're working on a free book program so they can send in email us for a free book, in which we'll be able to then know who they are. We'll know how to get a hold of them, and we just want to let a lot of people know, and that's just something that I'm really passionate about, that we don't keep this revelation hidden. We actually let as many people as possible hear about it. So that's ongoing, and a lot of what Inner Life International does is act as kind of a think tank, and like a visionary think tank, where we look into the over at the horizon and we say, what could we put out there in the future? What isn't happening right now that could happen? In other words, we're not afraid to explore that. We're wanting to look at it. And one idea we've been working on is, we call it the Cosmic Roadshow, which is just a way to take young adults, for example, to sign them up to a program, so maybe they'd spend a week or a month or a year working with the revelation. We would help get them some funding, we'd get them spots along the way to stop. Say if we did a Northeast tour in next spring, we'd have maybe 10 locations. We'd have readers that would take them into their house and set up places for them to speak and perform. And they would take the revelation out into the streets and to churches and community centers and into parks and just anywhere they could find an audience, and hand out literature and speak with people one-on-one. And it's
Tom,
something that hasn't been done.
Let me just interject for a second. I think it's great you're doing that, because I think there's been a sort of, we talked before about this kind of slow growth mentality. There's also been a perception, I think, among some readers that, we shouldn't do that. That's too... Then people are going to think we're a bunch of, freaky evangelists and so on and so forth. And the fact is that people out there are hungry. And, the other thing, and I come from a Christian background, so I'm a little biased, but, I just don't see anything wrong with street ministry. I don't see anything wrong with, you know, as long as you don't, you know, it's all in your approach. You don't have to shove it down people's throats. But, you know, just being out there in a public setting, a public forum, knowing that you have, I mean, it's, you're just, you know, you're offering bread to hungry souls. And I think to, you know, I just think that's great. I really do. And the other thing I wanted to say also, just about the slow growth mentality, and I think we have this false dichotomy going on, I think, in a lot of places in the movement where people think, you know, we should either go really, really slowly or we should try to get us into light and life tomorrow. And I think that both of those are really unnecessary. I mean, the slow growth people will tell you that I'm doing too much by having this broadcast, as if I'm this broadcast is not like we're on Oprah here. We've got a pretty select audience here, I don't see anything particularly radical about what I'm doing here. I think it's perfectly, you know, perfectly okay, you know. And then you've got the other people who will say, you know, you're not doing enough. We should get on Oprah right away, you know. And I just think that, you know, that whole dichotomy is pretty unnecessary.
Yeah, just
even if we do everything we possibly can do, this is going to be a slow growth process.
Amen. Slow growth comes with hard work, Mo says. Yes.
Right.
So.
And
well,
I think the thing that's really, really a great idea is to actually train people about how to do outreach, how to introduce the book to people. I don't know that we've ever really done that before as a movement, where we've had workshops or coaching or materials that are really designed to help people practice introducing people to the book. And that brings up another program that Inner Life International is supporting, and that is the 365. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Well, the 365 Club comes out of the 50K, which is the program to introduce 50,000 young adults to the Rancher book in 5 years, which is kind of the main program I'm working on right now.
When did that start, Thomas?
Well, you know, what happened
it's
is
just
we,
starting.
We were at ICO8, right? There's like about 600 of us there. And we're on this UCLA campus, and there's, what, 50,000 students there or something, some ridiculous amount. And they're from all over the world. They're the brightest, the best and brightest from around the planet, right, come to study at that campus. And here there's 600 of us there, and we didn't lift one finger to introduce one person to the book. And I'm like sitting there thinking, no, wait a minute, something is wrong with this picture. You know, we should be out there, you know, letting these people know. I was really disappointed in our organization for a moment there. I just thought, we got to do better than this. And out of the top of my head, at the general council meeting comes this proposal, and I stand up in the last half hour of the meeting and said, hey, I think we should introduce 50,000 young adults to the Rancher book. And at that time, it was in 3 years. And everybody kind of looks at me and, you know, like, what are you talking about? And I just explained myself. I said, it's crazy. Here we are on campus, and we have no mechanism in place, no plan to introduce these bright students, you know, these hungry young people that are searching for answers. And so I kind of fleshed it out a bit, came up with a more detailed plan, and we passed it in the general council meeting. And so the fellowship has currently adopted this, and other organizations, I think, are close behind, and some of the societies have adopted it, and it's starting to gain some speed. And when I was at the last fellowship meeting in Orlando, I stood up and we were talking about it, and in that moment I knew that I personally would introduce one person a day from here on out. That's just what I knew I could do, because how can I suggest this program to people when I wouldn't do it myself? And so
tell us a little bit about what that experience has been like for you, Thomas, because you and I have spoken a bit about that. And in fact, you even shared your list with me, which was really amazing. You know, just the fact that you sort of kept track of everyone you introduced the book to.
You know, I just decided to start tracking it, and the first one was we were at the hotel, and I went to the receptionist, and I just started chatting with her, and she was very interested, and I thought, oh, okay. And I gave her a card, and she said, oh, yeah, I'll go on the Internet and look at this tonight. And, you know, it made me realize that it's not that hard to introduce people.
You're absolutely, you know, I totally agree with you, Thomas. And, you know, and I have to tell you, I'm a person that is, I don't introduce the book to that many people because I find it, well, I guess because of the Christian background I come from, which is pretty conservative, a lot of my Christian friends, if they knew I was reading it, they would be praying for my soul. But on the other hand, when it comes to total strangers, actually I think in some ways I think it's easier to introduce it to someone you don't know that you don't have any baggage with. But I think I guess one of the things I will say, even though a lot of my friends are very conservative Christians, something that I have talked about on the show, and it's really true, you'd be surprised at how many people are sitting in church who are just frustrated. They are hungry for something deeper than what they're getting in church. In fact, we had some months ago, we had a lady named Julia Dean on a show who wrote a book called Quitting Church, Why the Faithful Are Leaving in Droves and What to Do About It. And there are people who are believers, okay? They're leaving churches because they want something more than what they're getting. And, you know, there's a huge untapped market out there, so to speak, of people who are in church, who are spiritual, but are tired of just the religion. You know, they want something deeper than, they want spirituality, they don't just want religion. So they want something deeper. And they are, I guess I'm just, again, supporting what you're saying, because I think there are a lot of people out there that are much hungrier than we think.
People are very hungry, and when I see somebody, I can usually sense if they're somewhat open, you know, and I can always find a way to start a conversation. I can always bring it around to something about their life and how they're doing, and, you know, there's always an opening, and I just find one, and then I ask them, hey, have you heard of the Urantia book? Because you say you like to read books, so you're a student, great, have you heard of the Urantia book? And they'll say yes or no. Usually it's a no, and I'll tell them about it and give them a card. And, you know, that's a very simple introduction. And some people I'll sit and talk to for an hour. They'll just say, tell me more. And some people, you know, I get calls from, you know, people that call me for whatever, for some kind of thing on my credit card or something. And next thing I know, we're talking about the Urantia book. And they say, well, let me get a pen. I got to write this down. And people are interested. People want to hear the good news. It's not... For some reason, our movement has this attitude that the world is not ready,
right?
And we'd be too pushy if we actually bothered to mention it to them.
Well, I think some people aren't ready. I mean, I guess I have kind of a mixed feeling about that, because I look at, as I mentioned before, I have a subgroup that I hang around with that probably isn't ready. I mean, I look at what Nathaniel said when Nathaniel and Jesus were talking, and Nathaniel says to Jesus, he says, you know, I get the sense that you only use parts of the scripture. You don't view the scripture the way the rabbis do. That the whole, you know, the words of the law are the very words of God, having been in existence, you know, with Abraham since, you know, the beginning. And Jesus says, yes, you've rightly judged. He says, you know, I'll share this teaching with you about the scriptures as long as you don't repeat this to your brethren who are not prepared to receive this teaching. So I think it's a question of discernment. There are times when we need to recognize, hey, you know what? These particular people are not ready for it, but that doesn't mean that other people aren't.
Yeah, and I think I've just changed my standards of who I think is ready. It used to be
maybe
1 in 100 is ready. Now it's like I'd say the people I bump into in a day, I'd say a good 50 or 60%. I would easily talk about it. You know,
yeah,
not,
I agree.
It's
with
not
you.
Like 1% or 5%.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. And the other thing too is that. And this is one thing that Paula told me several years ago, which is that Jesus talked to everyone he met as he passed by about their relationship with God, their personal relationship with God. And he didn't really follow up. You know, it wasn't like he called them back a month later to find out, hey, how's your personal relationship with God going?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's partly been... a change in my approach, too, is that I will introduce the book to as many people as I can in as many situations and opportunities that I have. But I don't take it personally if they don't become, you know, instant fans of the Urantia book.
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
It's our job to, I'm sorry, Thomas, let me just say,
well,
I think it's
yeah.
our job to plant seeds. You know, if you plant seeds, I think that's great. I do think there is a place for follow-up, though. One of the things that I've discovered, and I know we're kind of getting on a tangent here, but one of the things that frustrated me about study groups when I first started going is they were so reticent about being pushy. They didn't want to be pushy with people. That when new readers came, they didn't make them feel welcome, you know. And so they you know, what happened is people, you know, I mean, I think the churches, a lot of the churches are right. I think it would be great if we had a welcome card at study groups and you know, called the person back and say, did you enjoy yourself? Would you like to come back, you know?
I think that's a really good point, Andre. I don't think there's really any excuse for unbrotherly behavior towards our fellow believers. And I know many people have come to study groups over the years and have been, you know, ignored or shunned or haven't felt really welcome. And that's one of my passions, is really trying to teach people how to love one another. You know, it's one thing for us to have the commandment that we love one another. But for some of us, it isn't really very easy. We might be naturally shy, or we might be naturally hypercritical. And we have all of the tools in the Urantia book to learn how to love one another. It says that we need to get to know one another, learn each other's sentiments and motives, and that will ripen into friendship, and that friendship will grow into love. And
there always has to be a starting point for that to happen. And when we actually go out and contact our fellows, you know, and it doesn't have to be just about the Urantia book, but that does lead to that opening where you actually get to know somebody, and then eventually, yeah, it ripens into a much better, you know, a loving relationship. I want to say something about what we're talking about as far as introducing people. I was, you know, I went down to speak to the society in Los Angeles a few weekends ago, and we went out to the Venice Beach area where Norm Ingram sets up a booth once in a while, and we were just walking up and down, handing out our nice, beautiful new cards we're so proud of, and we came by one booth vendor there, and we started talking to him, and he says, that's it. This is the third time I've heard about this book. I'm just going to go read it now, you know. What it made me realize is that the first time somebody tells somebody, it's not maybe the one where they'll say, okay, I'm going to go get this book. But if there's enough of us out there telling enough people, eventually people are just going to say, okay, I give up, I'll go get a book. You know? So sometimes a little bit of persistence really does pay.
One of the other things that I think would be very helpful in introducing people to the book is having an overview of the book, some kind of a Reader's Digest version of the book that would focus on the most important things that we've each gotten out of the book, or that some of us have the kinds of things in the book that we really wanted to know and that really changed our perception of God and the universe and our place in the universe. Because I have a lot of friends who are very spiritually lit, who are really interested in the milk of the book, so to speak, but they just may not be really interested in all the meat, you know, all the really gristly parts of the book. What do you think about that?
Well, what I'm wondering is how do we know what each person is going to respond to, you know? I think each of us has that ability to say, you know, I think my friends would respond to a little pamphlet I'm going to develop on, you know, and then you try it and you see, is there a response? And if it really works good, then tell everybody, hey, this pamphlet works great, you know, here, use it, and we put it up on the website, people can download it. And some things I've tried just frankly didn't work, but I was willing to try them because it led me to the next thing that worked better, you know, so I think...
Yeah.
Yes.
I want to make sure we hear from Meredith here, but I want to Meredith, you've been so patient with us here on the phone, but I want to say one thing about what you just proposed, Crystal, because I think it's a great idea. Again, I want to talk a little bit about some of the old guard mentality here, because what I've heard from a lot of people is they'll say, oh, well, you know, Bill Sadler Jr. tried to write an Idiot's Guide to the Forward, and he was stopped from doing it. But, you know, it wasn't the right time to do that. I mean, first of all, I think that, you know, what we need to happen is that, you know, teachers and leaders need to be trained. But we've got teachers and leaders now. We've got a lot of them. I think we need to look at the parable of the talents and what the Urantia book says about it. Because I think some people, you know, they want to preserve the book in stone, you know, and they want to, you know, the midwares tell us what a shame it would be if, you know, 1,000 years from now, the master's followers said, oh, master, we didn't change your teachings, we didn't do anything, you know. And, you know, this is, the revelation is not here for us to bury it. And I think that this includes things like, I mean, if you look at what people do with the Bible, you know, I think that that's a good paradigm. We have different translations of the Bible. We have books about the Bible. We have people who just hand out the New Testament in the hotels. We have, study Bibles. We have the Bible for dummies, as they call it, you know, these days. We have all kinds of different things. And, you know, I think people are so afraid, well, they're just going to read those books instead of reading the Bible. But, you know, that's not the purpose of those books. Those are supplemental teaching tools. It's no different than going to a workshop and being taught by someone else. In this case, the person just put their teachings down in writing. So, you know, and it's funny, by the way, and I'm going to make a very controversial statement here on the air, which I am prone to do, and that is I think that what Harry McMullen did with the part four, we just published part four, was perfectly fine. And I think that that there's nothing wrong with that. And I think that I think it's a good paradigm. I mean, he didn't change the text at all. He just only published parts of it. Is it better to give people nothing rather than part of the truth? I mean, if we're giving people what they can assimilate, isn't that something that we should be doing? I mean, I don't know. I just don't understand the reaction against what Harry did. I mean, that's just, I don't want to get into a whole tangent. That's just one example, though.
Well, we had an interesting comment on the chat room just a few seconds ago about, you know, how do we know who's ready for the book? And somebody had commented about, you know, do people, you know, have signs on their head saying ready or not ready? We can't really make those decisions. We pretty much have to just go out there and tell everybody we see about it and let them decide if they're ready or not ready.
Right.
I would just like to interject that there is a balance here, which I think it's vital we all hold in our intention. And that is the understanding that the book is scaffolding to spiritual growth. But what is really transformative to our world at this time and to the individual is the living experience of relationship with God. And I strongly support the handing out of your answer books, but that also has to be done with the realization that true transformation comes from creating a living experience of deity, and that is almost our greater challenge. At least they have to be done hand in hand, because the book alone cannot do it.
Yeah, that's
a great point, Meredith.
Yeah.
Excellent.
And I also would say that that as far as who's ready, I guess I don't necessarily agree that we just hand out the book indiscriminately. I mean, I think we do have to use our discernment. I think that, you know, we have, you know, just like we wouldn't just, you know, as I said, you know, Jesus related to everybody differently. I think we need to meet people where they are. But I think your approach, Meredith, what you just described, I think is a great idea, because I think if we could share, you know, if you can talk to people, we don't have to talk to people about the book right away. We can talk to people about certain concepts, and then, especially if we can build a relationship with someone. And I realize that's not always possible. But anyway, since you just interjected, Meredith, why don't we transition here and start talking to you about this marvelous idea called the Garden Project? What is a What is the Garden Project?
Well, short and simple, it's the idea and the intent to reestablish the Garden of Eden. It's taking the knowledge that we all hold in the fifth epical revelation that a normal planet has such a garden that plays a critical role in the evolution of that planet towards light and life, and creating the intent and holding the space for that to reoccur here, now, again. And I think that it's vital that such an endeavor be held by a wide variety of people. It cannot be held just by your Urantia Book readers, but ultimately needs to be owned by Buddhists and Taoists and Baha'i. Because
yes,
the garden on a normal world belongs to everybody.
So how do you propose to do this?
How do we propose to do this, Andre?
Okay.
Well, I am really excited by the outcome of the Garden Conference, which brought together a group of individuals who were deeply consecrated, dedicated to this proposal. And one of the most substantive outcomes of the conference was setting in place an administrative body who could make decisions for the garden. And we now have a garden council. I'm really proud and delighted to say I think we've got a really strong crew of individuals who are gender balanced. There's relatively equal numbers of males and females. They're diverse in their representation of every sector of the Urantia movement. And they're all individuals with a tolerant spirit and good interpersonal skills, whom I hope will work productively together to help carry this idea forward.
How did you come up with this idea, Meredith?
Well, it wasn't just my idea. I think that it's the dream of a new garden has been in the hearts and minds of many of us for years. Christina Seaborn told me the first time she read the Urantia book, when she finished the last page, she closed the book and thought, golly, we need a new garden.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of people who have had that thought. Obviously, when you presented this idea at ICO8, it really caused quite a stir. And tell us a little bit about how you got the nerve, I would say, to do a workshop.
That's a great question, Crystal. And how did I get the nerve?
Well, I went on a spiritual retreat in on the ocean in Maine last June, and was talking with Father about what he wanted me to do. And the vision for the garden just kind of poured forth from me. And as I sat there fearfully thinking, golly, how could I do that? I went for a walk out on the beach, and it was such a gorgeous evening. And I just had a little vision there that if I would start running with this idea, that two big angels would come along on either side and lift me and the project right off the ground. I guess that has given me the faith that what we mortals start with spiritual assistance can accomplish amazing things.
True.
Well, coming from someone who was at your garden retreat in North Carolina, I have to say it was a really amazing event. I mean, it was awesome. There was a feeling among everyone who was there that, first of all, this was not a completely pie-in-the-sky dream. This was something we could begin to do together. And there was an excitement or an enthusiasm and a profound sense of fellowship that we had all come together to utilize our unique vision to help make this a reality, and that this was sort of an historic moment. It was a pretty awesome experience being there, and I know from what I've heard from other people who attended that it was pretty universally that way for everyone who was there.
It's great.
What kind
to
of
hear
feedback?
You
What kind of feedback have you gotten?
Oh, I have had very positive feedback from everyone that was there. And I know I came home deeply soul satisfied and thought that things could not have gone better.
Wow.
And one of the most surprising and amazing experiences was that here was a group of individuals from every sector in the Urantia movement, and one would have expected that there would have been conflict, that people would have taken offense to each other's approaches. But in fact, that didn't happen at all. It was pretty totally harmonious.
Sounds like a dream come true. That sounds almost too good to be true.
Well, maybe when we set ourselves a spiritual goal and commit our hearts to working towards that, it is easier to overcome our ideological differences.
Yeah.
So, Mary, could you say something about what this will look like? Because if I was a listener listening in, I'd want to know, well, what's it going to look like when it actually happens? I mean, do you kind of see those pieces falling together, and what's that look like?
Well, my experience, Thomas, in working with spirit is that it's extremely hard to forecast exactly how something is going to look. And the more we set a rigid idea in our own minds of how it's going to appear, the more difficult it is for spirit to mold the circumstances into the situation that spirit desires. So I would counsel all of us from getting anything too absolutely set in stone. But if I could share my own personal vision of how it would look,
please.
I would say this would be a both and. The Garden of Eden on a normal world is both a headquarters and a model of spiritual community, something that is vitally needed at this time. And at the same time, it is also a network of spiritual communities that exists in satellite form around the globe. So I would both like it to be a network as well as a one headquarters.
Right.
Someone on the board just asked, where is this garden located?
Our minds.
Well, you know, something very exciting transpired at the garden conference. We went in the first evening, and Rob Rochelleau, whom some of you may know, was there with a presentation he had brought with him, a PowerPoint presentation on site selection for the garden. And he has done seven professional site selection analyses at the University of Massachusetts in the last year and a half. And he really brought his expertise with him. And it was exciting to see that we had a leader in the group who could really spearhead a task force to go forward and evaluate a variety of site possibilities. And Rob has volunteered to do that.
Now, is one of the sites the original site of the original garden, which is in Mesopotamia?
Well, I think that it is up to our administrative body, the Garden Council, to make decisions about exactly where we're going to evaluate as possible sites.
So what I'm hearing, Mayor, is that there will be kind of a main site and then a lot of satellites. Yeah. That
yes.
would be different sites. Uh-huh.
And I think, personally, I think the process of site selection needs to move forward fairly quickly at this juncture. We are looking at some interesting possibilities for fundraising, but I recognize that the two need to go hand in hand to a certain degree. It's hard for all of us want to have something definitive in front of us when we're talking about contributing funds, and that means having some projected site in place. So I'm hoping over the next 6 months a lot of headway will be made to help determine which sites are good possibilities.
Yeah, one thing we've talked a lot about in Inner Life International is this idea of transformation centers. And it's just a concept that we've bantered around. And so when Mara came up with the garden project, to me it seems like, oh, it's the same thing with a different name. And it's really similar in the sense that the satellite communities would be, you know, I can visualize people going to the main garden site, which would be like a spiritual university or a spiritual training center, like if Adam and Eve were still here, we'd have such a thing. And then you go back home to your community and you bring the knowledge and you share it with people through a small satellite center or you know, some type of function where that information is revealed to your local community. And I love the idea of being visible, you know, where people can actually walk into a building and there's somebody to talk to and they can sign up for a class or sign up for a program or just grab some literature or just do anything, grab a video and have access to this revelation in the various formats that it's being recreated in and presented in. So this is exciting to me. This is exactly what I'd like to see happen on the planet.
You know, in a short answer to that question, what would it look like? If there's anyone in our listening audience who would like to know more about that, I encourage them to visit the website and look at the last page, which is a timeline for the Garden Project.
What is the website? Can you give that out?
Yes, it's www.rebuildthegarden.com. And the timeline lays out a projection of what it might look like and where we might be 18 months down the road, 3 years down the road, 5 years down the road. And, of course, nothing is carved in stone there, but it's at least a skeletal outline of where I hope the Garden Project will go. However, the administrative authority for decisions is clearly in the hands of our Garden Council at this point.
So, Mara,
you want to talk a little bit about some of the visioning processes that went on at the garden retreat?
Well, there were five groups that met. The first was administrative and governance and financial sustainability, and that group met over on the West Coast at Kindred Spirits. And they came up with some exciting ideas for us about how we might fundraise. One includes the possibility of a traveling art exhibit to engender income, and fascinated to see how that is going to play out. The second group dealt with art and culture in the garden, and there was a third group on spiritual.
It was actually art, family, culture, and education.
Well, I think you were on that group. So
you think?
You could probably speak to that better than I could, Crystalline.
Well, I was just going to say that we did include quite a bit in that umbrella of that breakup. But yeah, we talked about the arts, culture, and family culture. Family education, and education from the cradle to the grave, and basing the family culture and education on the original Edenic model of man and woman in equal partnership working together in the garden and educating children and having sort of a large extended family culture. It's pretty exciting.
And thank you. And then there was the site selection committee, and they developed a comprehensive list of criteria for what we should be looking for in considering a site. And there was the Spiritual Life and Healing Arts Committee, and lastly, Garden Interface and Communications, which dealt a lot with communicating what is going on in the Garden Project with our larger community and with the rest of the spiritual community. And anyone who is interested in seeing the plans that came out of that conference can, I hope within the next week to 10 days, take a look at them on the Wikipedia site at www.danal.org. And there's also a lovely capacity to write comments and participate in editing some of the plans.
Wait, I'm sorry, I'm confused now. What's the difference between the the Wikipedia site and the, you're talking about the Rebuild the Garden site?
Well, the Rebuild the Garden site does not have a Wikipedia capacity. Danal.org does, and they have volunteered that to the Garden Project. So there's a mechanism there for people to be able to go in and not only read about the planning that was done, but post comments and help in editing the plans.
Okay.
Now, that is not in place yet, but I hope it will be with.
Now, I have a strange question for you. Was Robert Sarve asked at that conference by any chance? Because I know he was interested in, he's always been interested in the archaeological aspects of it, but I was wondering if he was there to talk about it.
No, he wasn't.
Oh, interesting.
You know, one of the most profound statements made at the conference was, I thought, made by Rob Davis, who said, you know, we need to take the weight off of our shoulders, that it's our responsibility to go out and create a whole new center, a global center of art and culture, in the sense that we all know a Garden of Eden exists on a normal world. He said, instead, we need to look at Van and Amadon as the pattern setters for ourselves, and what it is important for us to do is to create a field of intent and ground that on the ground in some actual action steps on a physical locale, and then taking the simple steps that are before us, wait for spirit to come in and transform that. And when you think about that, it's a terrible relief. You know, there's no way, even if every Urantia book reader in the world came together to help with this project, I'm not sure there's any way we could build a global center of art and culture. But what we can do is create the intent to do that. We can invite spirit into that space, and we can ground that on an actual physical locale and allow spirit to create that vision.
Meredith, some people didn't hear what the wiki address was, if they want to find out more about the different groups' visioning that came out.
The wiki
Could you repeat that?
Yes. www.daynal.org. And if you put Garden Project into the search engine there, it will take you. But again,
thank you.
It will probably be 10 days before those plans are up on the site.
Okay, thanks. Well, that is a really exciting idea. And one of the other things that we talked about was, you know, if you're thinking of the Van and Amadon model, who, they knew that eventually there was going to be a material son and daughter arriving on the planet, but they didn't know when. But they took it upon themselves with total faith to build this place, this Garden of Eden, so that they would have a place to land, basically. And this idea is somewhat similar to that. We have no idea when our cosmic helpers are going to arrive, but we don't know how long it'll take us to get this built or to have it really functioning. So we might as well start now.
Yes, we had. And because we know that Jesus is coming back someday. He's promised us that. And there are certainly signs that our world is at a point of great change.
Well, okay, but I think Crystal's point, though, is we don't know how long this is going to take. I mean, I think there are a lot of speculation, for example, that the Urantia book is, I've heard a lot of people say the Urantia book is supposed to last 1,000 years, and I don't know if after that 1,000 years we're supposed to have another revelation. Of course, the other possibility is that the word 1,000, that the word, the book is simply using the word, or the book uses the word millennium at one point. It says the Urantia will not settle down complacently for a millennium. There's a possibility, though, that the word millennium there is being used poetically or symbolically. If you look in the Bible, for example, the word 1,000 is often used that way. Like, they'll say God owns the cattle on 1,000 hills. So I guess I should say two things. One is, I don't think we know how long it's going to take. Secondly, this is where I guess I'm going to go take the slow growth route here again, because I think there are some people who act like, you know, we're going to hit light and life tomorrow, and I guess it doesn't matter, though, to me. I think what matters is that we do the work, you know?
Uh-huh.
Exactly. I agree, Andre, and I think it's critical that one takes on this project with the understanding it doesn't matter when help arrives. What's important is that we take the information we've been given and use it as productively and spiritually fragrantly on the planet as we can.
One of the other workshops that I attended at IC08 was one that was led by, it was basically on the 100 from Dalmatia. And what were they supposed to have done here? And since we now know what their mission was supposed to have been, you know, would it be out of the question for us to sort of take that up and start? Jim McNally, that's who it was who put this on. Anyway, it was a great workshop. It was actually a very funny experience being there because Jim was leading it. But we talked about, what would that look like if we were trying to rebuild that mission? And so in some ways it had a lot in common with the rebuilding the garden ideal. What are the areas that we need to relearn from a planetary cultural perspective? What have we gotten wrong so far, and what do we need to relearn?
Well, from a certain common sense perspective, we are at a juncture on the planet where it is highly useful to take all the information we've gotten from the fifth ethical revelation and try to pull that, integrate that into models of spiritual community. It is evident that we are all going to have to change the way we have been living. And I think the world is full of spiritually hungry people looking for a different, more soul-satisfying way to live. So from our perspective, it makes utter sense to do this, regardless of whether help ever comes in our lifetime or not. And there's the encouraging thought that when Vam and Amidon set out to do this, they didn't actually complete their plans. Help arrived when they were only a quarter done. So
right.
That fills me with hope.
Now, it's been we're through the first hour of the show now, and we've got only about 51 minutes remaining, and I think it might be a good time to ask any callers that are interested in asking our guest questions to call in. We have one caller who's been waiting on the line. Let's see if it's someone who has a question or a comment or is just calling to listen in. Hold on. 425, you're on the air. Hello? Okay,
I wonder if that's Tom Choquette.
No, I don't think so. But anyway, they're muted. So 425, if you have any comments or questions, I'll try you again in a few minutes. All right, so I wanted to ask a little bit more, not to derail Meredith here in your discussion about the garden, but I want to go back to Thomas's 50K in 5 project and to flesh that out a little bit more, too. What exactly is your vision for that program?
Well, you know, if I had a magic wand, I think what I would do is I would use my pixie dust too, just to get extra boost, and I would have teams emerging on the planet, especially in the United States, and like say the East Coast would have some teams, the West Coast, Florida, Midwest, where people would say, hey, I'll start a team, and I'm going to get some people together. We're going to make sure we got everything we need, and we're going to get our group together. And to me, the driving thing that really drives the 50K program is when each person as an individual looks at who they are and says, you know, I've only introduced like 10 people in a year. I think I'm going to raise that to 50. You know, it's all about recommitting who you are for your fellow man and saying, I can do better. If I really commit to it and really focus on it, I'm going to do better. And then work, take that commitment and work with a group of people that will support you in it, and then go ahead and set up a group that will set some goals, work together, maybe go on some campuses, do a little research, find out what the local colleges allow for, you know, outside groups to come in and set up a table, or just to be on campus handing out literature, or give talks at the university. And it doesn't just have to be on campus. It can be anywhere where you find people. But just come up with a plan that works in your community to get out on the street, basically, and get out into the public arenas, the highways and byways, as Jesus had his ambassadors do, and start sharing the good news. And if we just do that, you know, that will start to kind of snowball into, well, gee, this is working. What if we did, you know, then take it to another level? And I'd also like to see a model put in place. We're working on this, but it's going to take some administrative support, some financial support, where we, and then this idea comes out of being on a campus and seeing like the Navy or the Army there signing up people to go fight in wars and sign up to serve the country, which is maybe noble and maybe questionable, but why aren't we there signing up people to be in the peace army? You know, hey, we want you to sign here. And so my sense is that we need to take these young, idealistic youth that are looking to make a difference in the world and say, hey, here's an alternative. Why don't you sign up with us for a year? We'll help get you some funding. We're going to train you to be a peacemaker and a sharer of the gospel. And we're going to put you on the road, and we got some great stops. And by the way, you get to go rafting when you're in Oregon. And when you come to Idaho, you're going to climb a mountain. And, you know, we're going to have some adventures mixed in, but we're also going to be taking you out. And, you know, we're going to go on and share the good news with people. And that'll be our purpose and our mission. And every time you stop someplace, we're going to have, the host is going to have a little bit of training for you. You know, a part of the deal is they're going to feed you and put you up for the night, but then there's going to be an hour discussion after supper. Or maybe it's going to be in speaking presentation skills or how to, you know, share the gospel better or a deeper understanding of some aspect of what we're doing. That way, the great readership I mentioned that has so much wisdom and so much knowledge actually gets tapped to become trainers for the new generation that's coming along that doesn't have 20 years of reading the book under their belt. They've maybe only had the book a year or something, and they're kind of, you know, wet behind the ears. And we want to make sure that we have that mentorship system in place, that we're developing well-rounded servants of the gospel. And over time, I think we're going to have a large army of dedicated, trained, you know, service workers that are going to go out and turn the world upside down.
And this is where you and I really join together, Thomas, because as you know, the garden is, if anything, primarily a place where young spiritual leaders are trained. And
yes,
certainly in a network scenario where they move from place to place and so, often come into a headquarters to get training and then go back out again.
And that's why I like the satellite idea so much, is we have some main centers or center, but that is really there to help spawn sub-satellite groups. And even if you don't have a physical center in your community, you can say, I am the center. when you see me, you're going to see these values shared and being, happening in my community. So we don't have to have a physical location to have the garden idea or the transformation center idea work. We each choose to be the source of that, just like Jesus commissioned his ambassadors to be, disciples of the kingdom, ambassadors of the kingdom. You are the salt, Like, go out there and salt the world. Plant these seeds of the gospel. And that's all I think we're looking to do, is to find more people that are willing to say, hey, I don't know exactly how it's going to look, but I'm willing. Sign me up. Let's work together. Let's make this happen. Because if you look at the world right now, it's in kind of sorry shape, and it's there because we have so much material advancement and so much media manipulation and so much, but we don't have the spiritual counterpart that is really residing in the teachings of the Urantia book.
Let me ask you something, Tom, because it's funny you should mention the world being in sorry shape, and do you think, I've heard a lot of Christians talk about this. Actually, one particular person I know thinks that the economic situation is going to get worse and worse, but he thinks that it's going to be an incredible opportunity for revival.
Andre, I'm having a hard time hearing you. Can you say that again?
Hold on a second here. Okay, I'm sorry. There we go.
That's better.
Yeah. What this person was saying to me was that a lot of Christians would say this. One particular person I know said that as the economic situation gets worse and worse, and he thinks it's going to get really bad, but he also thinks it's going to be a real incredible opportunity for spiritual revival. And I was just wondering, do you think that if material conditions continue to get worse in the world, do you think this could really be an opportunity as well for us for people to really recognize their hunger? Their spiritual hunger? Do you think this could be a real, real fertile ground?
Well, what I noticed is, like, when I started reading the book, late 60s, early 70s, it was like the end of the Cold War, and there was not a hunger for truth back then. People were very satisfied with churches, and there was some fallings out happening, and there was like the hippies came along and they were questioning, but it wasn't like now. It's like people are just like, what is going on? There's like this huge question mark stamped on everybody's forehead. And I think the time has never been better than to be, to be visible. And if you look at what's happening in the world, the world is really the shadow of the spirit, right? It's like the shadow. There's not enough spiritual fulcrum here, and so what we see in the world is kind of a material malaise, a lot of confusion and disorientation and, wars and financial upsets and divorces. I mean, it's really a big mess out there. And I think we know from reading the book that the only answer is to have spiritual insight. We can't.
It's funny though, Tom, because you said you started reading the book in the late 60s, and you said that there wasn't as much hunger back then. I guess I always got this impression that people were more spiritually hungry, that they were asking deeper questions, with the peace movement and the hippie movement and that kind of thing.
Well, that was kind of a small subgroup that got a lot of media attention, but it was the beginnings of something that started. Of course, it's always been going on.
Okay.
There was the beatniks before that, goes, you can kind of always find a certain percentage of the world that's hungry, but a lot of people then were kind of complacent. And that complacency has kind of gone away, and it's kind of been replaced with confusion and hunger, and it's almost like people are like itchy for something. It's like, what? There's got to be something better, because this is not working, And when I talk to people, and there's nothing better than getting out on the street and talking to people about the Urantia book, because you hear their stories, you ask them, it's like, well, how's it going? How's your religious life? And, are you satisfied? And you just ask them questions, depending who they are. And most people are really confused. You don't hear so many people anymore that say, oh, I just love my religion. I'm just, thoroughly happy, you know. You don't hear that. You kind of hear people saying, you know, I don't know what to think anymore. It's
right.
Just, I've tried this, I've tried that, it's not working, I've kind of given up. And then when you share something new with them, they say, wow, I've never heard of this. Where's it been? I've been looking, you know, I've been checking things out for years. I've never heard of this book. You know, where's it been? And it's like we're doing the community, the world community, a great disservice by not full force introducing tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people to the book. It's like how dare we not let them know?
Well, that's an interesting way of looking at it.
well, what right do we have to have these stores of knowledge, but yet we don't invite anybody in to look at our warehouse full of knowledge? You know, it's like,
well, you know what? I think, as I mentioned before, you know, the book says that your rancho will not settle down complacently for a millennium. Maybe it's not supposed to. You know, if we were settled down complacently, then people wouldn't want the revelation. They wouldn't be hungry for something.
Right.
You know, and it's only, I think what that means is we will only settle down, that we'll settle down complacently once this world has been, once a significant percentage of people in the world have accepted this. And I think, you know, the other thing is I think that the revelators knew that we were going to enter this time of uncertainty. I mean, they say so in the book. They say we're headed to uncharted waters. And I think when that happens, people are going to want, you know, they're going to want something stable in their lives that's going to hold them up.
Yeah, these are such great times, Andre. I mean, it's just like, you know, if I was to pick a planet to come to and a time to come to a planet, I would have picked this one because, you know, it's just in such a tumult. And everything is just moving so fast and there's so much chaos that to be somebody who loves service, that wants to make a difference in the world, it's like, wow, did I pick the right place or what? You know, because there is so much to do. There's just, you could not exhaust what there is to do. I mean, you could never get it all done. You know, it's just, you know, go for it. There's plenty for everybody, right?
Andre, I think your Christian friend is right on. And with you, Thomas, it's hard for me to conceive of a more exciting time to be alive. I think the Urantia book states it clearly for us in paper 195 under Christianity's Problem, when it says, religion does need new leaders, spiritual men and women who will dare to depend solely on Jesus and his incomparable teachings. The spiritual renaissance must await the coming of these new teachers of Jesus' religion who will be exclusively devoted to the spiritual regeneration of men. And then will these spirit-born souls quickly supply the leadership and inspiration requisite for the social, moral, economic, and political reorganization of the world. We are standing on the cusp of that, and Spirit is calling us to help create that reality. And as we think about programs like 50K and the Garden Project, I think we need to recognize that it is not just we mortals who are standing at the forefront with these little ideas. It is a legion of celestial assistants behind us. The Melchizedeks are there. The Finaliters are there. The Seraphim are there. Michael and Mother is there. The Magisterial Mission is there. And they are going to help us accomplish the amazing task that lies before us.
Well, you know what's so exciting about this, Meredith and Tom, is that, you know, it's really interesting as you were quoting that passage from paper 195, and I've heard that passage quoted, you know, off and on in study group, but it was always quoted abstractly as if it was some hypothetical thing. And now you're actually talking about, you know, you're actually doing this. You know, we're doing this. I mean, this is
we're
real.
We're doing it.
And we are. You know, we are part of that new generation of teachers and leaders. I mean, I don't mean that in an arrogant sense. It's just reality. That's part of what we're doing. And I think that's just so exciting to know that this is, that, you know, the book is, you know, is talking about us, at least in part. You know, they're not only talking about us, but they're...
That's,
you know,
one of the things that I think is so exciting about including training for our young people in this whole process is that, you know, they're the ones who are going to take this forward. And one of the other programs that we haven't talked about yet that ILI has been involved with is Training Leaders for Tomorrow. And we, one of the things that Thomas was talking about just in the last couple of weeks is putting together a youth leadership summit that is in some ways similar to the garden retreat that you had, Meredith, where it's a visioning event where we bring a large group of young people together and break into small groups like we did at the garden retreat and see what their vision is for the future and how can they get the training, how can we help them learn what they need to learn, get the training that they need, get the funding that they need to help those service projects get off the ground.
Yeah,
do you want
to
talk about that, Tom?
Yeah, to me that's really exciting because the youth are our future. And how many meetings have we been to where people look around and say, boy, a lot of gray hair here, you know, where's the young people? And I kind of have heard things that the young people kind of when there was some wars going on in our movements, you know, said, hey, let's just agree to stay out of those groups and, you know, let them work their stuff out. We're not going to get involved. And that's all well and good, but, you know, times are also changing. And now it's a time, I think, to reorganize ourselves, to work with the youth, to provide training opportunities for them or provide just a way. You know, to me, our job is to help the youth prepare themselves for their future service work. And there's a lot of talent in these young people, you know, like web design and media graphics. And,
right.
You know, they just know a lot of things. They're very smart. And sometimes they're smarter than us. And our job is to not get in their way by telling them what they should or shouldn't do, but to stand there alongside of them and say, what do you guys need? How can we help you? What would make you guys succeed? You know, we're committed to that.
And if I can interject, Thomas, worse than that, our job is to role model such dynamic spiritual living that it inspires others to follow in our footsteps.
Amen.
And also, Tom, you know, I think that's so humble of you, you know, to say that, you know, what do you guys need? I mean, that to me is a model of real healthy mentorship and leadership is, you know, and it's like Jesus said, you know, if you're going to be a good teacher, you have to be a learner. And recognize that you have things to learn from the young people as well. And I think that's wonderful. You know, there's something, I do understand the desire of the young people to stay out of the internal civil wars between the fellowship and the foundation and all that, but I don't think they're necessarily against organizations. I think they would be okay with the organizations if there was a sense of unity. And I think, as you said, the time has come to reorganize. So the thing that's great about something like ILI is it's not affiliated with either one of those groups. You know, it's a new thing. And I think that, you know, I can't criticize any of this. It's just great.
Can I share that? I had a real aha moment, Thomas, on the ILI board meeting this last week, because you and I and many others sat in meetings 3 or 4 years ago with ILI and had visions of training dynamic spiritual leaders leading to global transformation. And they seemed such pie-in-the-sky ideas at the time. But the marvelous realization I had this last week was that ILI is currently engaged in Cosmic Cafe, engaged in 50K, engaged in the youth day camps to some degree down in Florida, engaged in Free Schools World Literacy, engaged in the Garden Project. ILI is doing a lot of things on a lot of fronts, and a lot of abundant fruit is coming forth from those efforts. So I think that we are somehow accomplishing some of the things we set out to do.
Definitely.
And 4 years is not very long.
Well, I think if you hold a vision, you know, my coach is named Leslie, and Leslie said to me once, said, Thomas, you know, your job is just to hold the vision. I said, Leslie, there's all these things to do. And she said, no, Thomas, you just hold the vision, and people will come, and the vision will happen. You have to have faith. And I think all of us that see a vision have to hold tight to it and then share it with others. Say, this is the vision. The garden's the vision. Cosmic Phase is the vision. Ambassadors, you know, youth on the road, whatever it is, we'll hold that vision. And the more of us that hold it, the sooner we'll actually see it in reality, because as we hold the vision, as we nurture the vision, eventually the pieces start to fall together. We have to give the angels a little bit of time to connect the dots for us, you know, and they will make the connections. And next thing you know, somebody's on the phone and like, oh, who are you? And like, oh, wow. And things start to happen, right? And our job is just to know that it will happen. And I want to say something, too, about something I see a lot in the movement is our reasons why we can't have certain things, right?
Yeah.
So all we
reason,
oh, we don't have enough money, or oh, it's not the time yet, or oh, we tried that once. And something I learned in Landmark Education is they have a saying that says that either you have what you want or you have your reasons why. Choose. So either you'll have what you want, which is a vision coming into fruition, or you'll sit there with your reasons why you didn't do it, right? And what's the worst thing, I think, is to be in your deathbed, right, and you're looking back and say, oh, I wonder what my life would have been like if I would have chosen to do that thing, you know. You know, what a mistake to be, you know, at the end of your life and saying, gee, what if I had really dedicated myself to that program I thought about getting involved in? I mean, it totally transforms your life to get involved in some of these exciting adventures. So why would you just sit there with your reasons why you shouldn't do it when you could just do it, you know, and just enjoy it and meet all these new people and get involved in all these exciting things that are going on?
Well said, Thomas. Hmm? Well said. And when we step out to act with spirit, amazing things happen and our lives become more joyful. And the end result is always way beyond what we thought we could accomplish alone.
True. Boy, isn't that the truth? That is just such a good point to make. And that brings me back to one of the first things that my father told me about, not just about the book, but about working with God or getting to know God or doing God's will. I remember I was probably about six, and he said, you know, working with spirit, working with the Creator, working with the universe, doing God's will be more exciting, more thrilling, more adventurous, more fun, just better in every way than you could have ever imagined. And that was just such an excellent way to introduce me to God.
Well, sure, because so many kids are introduced to religion like it's, you got to go to church this Sunday, and like, well, do I have to go? You know, this is not about duty. He was telling you what a great adventure it's going to be.
You know, something else about 50K is that it's almost like there's some hidden bonuses, you know what I mean? When you kind of get into something, you don't realize there's little the open door number two, and there's a surprise behind it, you know? and people... And when you look at the goals of the 50K, you know, this program to introduce 50,000 young adults to the Urantia book, you know, when you start actually working with the team or you get out there, just even on your own and start introducing people, what happens is you start to notice some benefits start popping, like the doors start opening, right? Like people that you had no idea had an interest in spiritual stuff all of a sudden are asking you questions every day about the Urantia book, and next thing they're in your study group, and next thing they're working side by side with you, and next thing their kids are, and you know, it's like there's like a hidden benefit that there's like a resource that we can only tap if we take an action to reach out to our fellows, right? We have to kind of, it's kind of like we're a charged up battery. And we want to take our little cable and touch their little cable, right? And there's a spark that jumps across, and if they get that juice in their battery, then all of a sudden they're charged up. And our job is just to charge people with the enthusiasm and the joy of being involved in anything that moves the revelation forward. So,
well, I think in addition to that, our job is to create the space where networks can come together and work together. And we haven't done a really great job of that previously. I mean, I was thinking even with the Boulder School, where we had a center where young people could come and study the book in depth together for a set period of time. And they were really investing, you know, 2 years of their lives to the thorough study of the papers together. And then we graduated. And we didn't really have anywhere to go with it. We didn't really have any kind of mentorship or any sort of track to run on. And since I was one of those young people back then, I was, you know, I was definitely on fire. I had a lot of energy and enthusiasm. But I didn't really feel like there was anything set up for me to follow or to... there certainly wasn't a track.
You had to blaze
anything
your
that
own
I was
path.
I had to do it myself. I had to create my own path, and I didn't have any mentorship. One of the reasons I stayed in the Boulder area was because at least we did have a spiritual community. We did have a ranch community, and that really was enough for me at the time to stay and to pursue my own sort of service projects on my own. But how much more would I have been able to accomplish had I had mentorship and had I had the kind of networking possibilities that we have now? I mean, I'm blown away by the kind of opportunities that we have just through the network that the internet has created for us. It's such a powerful tool to bring us together, not just regionally, but all over the world.
And there's more good tools coming. I was at the IT Summit a couple of weeks ago in Denver, and it was really exciting to see the best and brightest minds in the web realm come together and share their ideas, because they'd never really kind of just all sat together in one room. And to watch the dynamics and the synergy that happened, and to hear about what's coming up for us as far as our new web capabilities, where anybody, I don't care who it is, if the way it's going to be in about a year, from what I understand, is if anybody has an idea or project, they can go on, there'll be a template where they can just create a website, it'll all be hosted, it'll all be taken care of. If you want to have a PayPal button where you can take funds, if you want to have a guest book, that'll all be there. You can just click and choose what you need for your website.
That's
and
awesome.
It'll be so much easier for us to launch new projects and programs.
And one of the things I want to say, and I really don't, because Thomas, I totally agree with what you're doing in the Ambassador Program. The reason that I mentioned, though, when I asked you if someone could be a mentor right away instead of always having to wait to be mentored, is because, you know, and I hope this doesn't come across as arrogant. I don't mean it to be. But, you know, I've spent so much of my life listening to other people tell me what to do and other people, you know. And I finally decided, you know, in the last couple of years, you know what, Andre, you've got leadership gifts. Go ahead and just start something, you know. So I started this show. I also started a life coaching website, which I'm putting on the back burner a little bit. But, you know, the point is, I think it's great that we're living in an age now where, I don't want to minimize the importance of training, because I think it's really important, but we're living in an age now where we don't have to wait to be certified or credentialed, you know. You can just start these websites and use, and then, you know, the thing is, we don't have that many teachers and leaders right now. So I guess the thing is, we need to be the teachers and leaders who are going to train the next generation as well. So there are, I'm sure, and I don't just want to speak for myself here, I'm sure there are people out here listening who already have the gifts, who already have the talents, who can train as well as be trained. And one of the things I love about this movement is they don't sit there and say, well, if you're going to do a workshop at a conference, if you're going to start a website, you're going to have to wait. You're going to have to wait a few years to get certified, you know, or whatever before you do this. I think it's great that we're letting people, we're trusting people and delegating stuff to people and trusting people to have, you know, to go ahead and do stuff. And even the young people, even though we're training them now, I think it's great to say, hey, you know, you don't have to wait. You know, if you have some ideas that you want to, you know, get started, get off the ground now, go ahead.
Well, I want to say, too, it's not just about training them. In many cases, they're the ones that will
training
be training up.
Absolutely.
And the reason I bring that up is I'm going to be doing a conference call tomorrow with a group of young leaders, leaders of tomorrow, some young people, some of whom are second-generation readers. Some of them have found the book on their own. But I really don't want to present this as a situation where I'm presuming to be training them.
Yeah.
It's really about a brainstorming session for them to bring to me what their passions are, what they're really interested in doing. If the sky was the limit and they had no resources that could not be gathered to support their dream, what would it be? What would they want to do? That's what I want to hear about.
And kudos to you, Andre, for your courage to step out with your own vision. And I really agree, Crystalline, that our task is to create a platform and a support system for all of us to move forward with our own spiritual leadership. And I think that there's a great quote that is sometimes attributed to Nelson Mandela. I think it was actually Marianne Williamson, and I can't remember it word for word. But the gist of it is, the greatest problem is our own inability to move into the potential greatness that is within each of us.
Uh-huh.
And as I look around our movement, for every one person who is perhaps carried away with arrogance, there are dozens who could do so much more than they do with just a little more confidence, with just a little more encouragement, with just a little more support.
Yes.
And it's okay, and you know what, and it's okay to ask, and it's okay to ask for that support. You know, one of the things that as a child I was taught, especially as a blind child, they wanted me to make sure that I was independent, you know, and I shouldn't ask for help. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with asking for support. There's nothing, not only is there nothing wrong with it, but we're supposed to. We're supposed to be interdependent. Look at all the celestial beings that we've got around us to assist us. So, you know, I just think that I would encourage everybody out there, you know, that's just a passion of mine, I guess, so.
Yeah, to me, what we're doing really is rethinking the movement in a way. You might say that it's like the movement has, you know, 50 plus year history, and it's kind of gone the way it's gone. And I think there's a growing number of us that are no longer willing to sit back and wait and hope something happens someday. We're actually going to say, okay, there's all of us that are wanting to make it happen are going to work together. We're going to make something happen. And it's okay if other people don't want to be involved, but one way I've looked at the Rancho movement as I've thought that if it was more of a spiritual corporation, especially like different organizations that exist, and just kind of change the thinking from, okay, we're a group of people that get together to socialize, to meet each other, you know, kind of shift from that model, which is a fine model. But take on this spiritual corporation. If we were a spiritual corporation, we'd say, okay, now we have, you know, widgets to sell, and our widget is the gospel, right, and sharing the revelation. And if we want to get the widgets out there to the public, how do we market our widgets? And, well, we got to have Salesforce. Okay, we got a Salesforce, but they don't know how to sell widgets. Well, we got to have training. We have to send our sales force off to get trained in how to sell widgets, you know. And when I think in that model, and it's really kind of like a slam dunk to say, well, gee, we need to have centers, garden centers, and training opportunities, and places where we sign up the youth and get them engaged in learning, you know, get me learning through doing projects and get them trained and, you know, really up on how to share the revelation. So it's not... it's not like difficult, but it's just like normal. It's just like that's the culture that we live in. It's like when you become a Urantia creator, you just naturally share it with people. It's not like weird. It's just like the culture that we live in. Does that make sense?
One of the topics that we've been discussing in the chat room is about, you know, being more familiar with the Bible when we're doing outreach. And Andre, you and I have certainly shared this experience, but we do a lot of outreach to Christians, you know, introducing the Ranch Book to Christians. And one of the comments made was, you know, we really need to know more about the Bible in order to do that. And that's one of the things that I hope we can include in part of our training for outreach for young people.
What I'd like to see too, Kristalyn, and maybe this is a good idea. Maybe we need to develop something about like this. I like to see different kinds of training for different kinds of outreach. I mean, I don't mean to segment everybody into little subgroups, but you know, the fact is we all have our gifts. And, you know, one of my gifts is I am familiar with the Bible. I love the Bible. I know it's not the Word of God, but it's got great stuff in it. And it does contain some of God's Word. So, you know, I think it'd be great if we could, you know, have a group of people that does specifically outreach to Christians and another group that does specific outreach to Muslims or whatever. I mean, there are all kinds of possibilities.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think the thing that, Tom, you're doing is really invaluable in helping us learn how to do more, because you really are literally introducing the book to at least one person a day. And there have been several days when you've introduced the book to a lot more than one person a day. And the basic idea behind 50K in 5 is to introduce the book to 50,000 people in the next 5 years. I mean, that's kind of an outrageous goal.
But if you
think about, you know, if each of us does it, let's say one person a day, that's 365 a day, and we've got a group of 1,000 people doing it, and then next year we have 10,000 people doing it, and then the following year we have 20,000 people doing it, you know, it really does spread pretty rapidly.
Yeah, to me, the goal might be too low. If enough of us get with it, so to say, and actually get really involved, I think 50,000 could go by in maybe 2 or 3 years if we really got with it, you know, and said, hey, let's just do this. And, you know, I think I figured that if there was 28 people doing 365 a day in 5 years, that'd be 51,000 people. 28 people is all it takes to be in a 365 club, and we're there. So what if we had 280 people doing 365 a year? Or what if we had 365 people doing 28 a year? We get the same result. So, it, you know, to me it's just a matter of people raising their level of what they think they can do. And what I noticed is, as soon as I said to myself, I'm going to introduce one a day, by 6 o'clock in the evening, if I hadn't introduced somebody, a little alarm clock went off in my head, said, remember, you said one a day, you know, wake up, you know. And my radar would go out, and I'd notice somebody there, and I'd start talking to them. Next thing, I'd have introduced them, you know. And it's only because I said I would do it. If I hadn't said I would do it, then I wouldn't even thought about it. But it's when we commit to something, and it's easy to do.
You know, and let me say this carefully, because I don't want to disparage your calling here, Thomas, in any way. Introduce 50,000 people. If that's what you feel called to do, I think you should do it. I'm just going to speak for myself. For me, numbers are not important. Do I want to introduce these concepts to people? Yes. I'm just going to. I guess what's important to me, and I know this sounds a little loosey goosey, but it's just to do what the Spirit leads me to do. You know, if the Spirit leads me to share the book with someone, I'll share it. If not, I won't. You know, or maybe the Spirit is going to lead me to do what Meredith suggested. And Meredith, we'd love to hear from you again, because you're sitting there quiet as a mouse. I think that, you know, as you said earlier, Meredith, you know, what about just introducing people, you know, sharing the gospel with people, sharing our experience with God. There are different people that I can share certain things with, and other people I can't share other things with. So I guess, you know, for me, what's important to me is just to be open to, as you said, Meredith, to, as you so graciously put it, and, you know, what Spirit is doing.
Well, I totally support the 50K movement. We need more people in the world who are aware of the fifth ethical revelation, beyond a doubt. But I also think we need to be aware that the Rancher Book does not tell us that global transformation is coming from having X number of people reading the Rancher Book, and that ultimately the even tougher task is to reveal the religion of Jesus, to live the religion of Jesus, rather than talk about the words in a book.
Absolutely. That's a really great point, Meredith. And I think that that is really where we want our training to focus, really, how to support our community, our youth, our young adults, in living lives that are really demonstrating the real gospel of Jesus.
I think a good thing to remember is that these ideas are not in conflict. Like, introducing the book is not in conflict with sharing the gospel.
That's true, too. You're right.
Yeah,
you're
because
right.
Some people say, oh, we should just share the gospel and don't tell them about the book. And, you know, they're not in conflict. If you
yes,
if you got
I
somebody you can
that.
Minister to, yeah, have at it. You know, like, let the Spirit speak through you. And if you have somebody you can introduce, hey, introduce them. You know, it's do it all. Yeah.
I agree, Thomas. It needs to be done in tandem.
Uh-huh.
And I think that one of the personal experiences that I've had recently that I'd like to share is this, that making that commitment to God, really consecrating your life to God, is a profound experience to have. And Meredith, I know you're experiencing that too with your recent ordination. But just making that your primary purpose in life really does bring all sorts of service opportunities, all sorts of outreach opportunities, all kinds of ministry opportunities. And it's a very life-changing experience. And, you know, once we take that step in our own lives, we will find all kinds of opportunities cropping up for us to share the gospel. Sometimes it might be in the form of sharing the book. Sometimes it might be in the form of just giving loving counsel to our fellows and being a living demonstration of love on the planet. But one of the things that it says in the Urantia book is, you know, dedicate your lives to proving that love is the most powerful force in the world. We all really need to do that.
I think, you know, Crystal, and I was really intrigued by your statement that you finished from the Boulder School. You had this great education about the Urantia book, but that you didn't quite know where to go with it from there. And it seems to me that our strongest suit, our strongest move forward is to, yes, go out with 50K and get 50,000 people reading the Urantia book who weren't before, but follow that up in tandem with, and if you're interested when you've read this book in doing more, why, we have service projects you can engage in, why, we have opportunities for your spiritual leadership to emerge that you may participate in. There needs to be a cohesive system, plan, by which we can move all of ourselves along from reading the book, to doing service, to becoming and living the religion of Jesus.
Yes, well said.
Very, very well said. We're back. We're down to about the last 5 minutes of the show.